This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. Security will be tight at the federal courthouse in Washington, D.C., where former President Trump appears tomorrow on four charges in the Justice Department's January 6th case. CBS's Scott McFarland.
The former president expected to arrive here with a Secret Service escort and a heavy police presence to enter a not guilty plea and then learn about any release conditions and restrictions in his case. Then the case shifts to federal judge Tanya Chotkin, a 2014 appointee of then President Obama. She has been strident in her denunciations of the January 6th attack. In hearings of January 6th riot defendants, she's called that day horrifying and a violent attempt to overthrow the government.
Trump will face charges of using dishonesty, fraud, and deceit to overturn the results of the 2020 election. A federal jury recommends a death sentence for the gunman who stormed a synagogue in the heart of Pittsburgh's Jewish community and killed 11 worshipers in 2018. A judge is expected to formally impose the sentence for Robert Bowers tomorrow. Audrey Glickman survived the shooting by hiding in a closet and says the recommendation sends the right message.
The purpose of the death penalty is not so much punishing as cutting off the person from society. Eliminating the evil, taking away the risk, the potential for infection, and the possibility of further harm to the citizens.
Evacuation efforts are underway as firefighters try to put out multiple fires in an industrial section of Phoenix. Fire Department Captain Kim Quick Ragsdale says crews are being rotated, monitored, and hydrated.
We have ladder pipes set up. We have multiple firefighters fighting it from all angles. And so, yes, this could take quite some time to put out just due to the size of this fire.
Wind-whipped flames have engulfed a variety of businesses. The National Institutes of Health picks a replacement for Dr. Anthony Fauci. Details from CBS's Alexander Tin.
In a joint statement, the Infectious Diseases Society of America and the HIV Medicine Association applauded the selection of Dr. Jeannie Marazzo from the University of Alabama at Birmingham, calling her an exceptional leader in the field, both in research and in mentoring the next generation of disease experts.
Pope Francis is on a five-day swing through Portugal during World Youth Day, but a big topic of conversation is a recently released report on clergy sex abuse allegations against the Portuguese Catholic Church. This woman traveled from Slovakia to Lisbon to see the Pope and says of the scandal,
"It's very sad that it's happening and it shouldn't, but I also think that the mass media are mostly exaggerating what's happening."
The pontiff has blasted Portugal's Catholic Church leaders and met with abuse victims. Stocks fall on Wall Street after Fitch downgrades the U.S. credit rating. This is CBS News.
If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Their end-to-end hiring system helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Civic Media Radio Stations, providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
For WCFW and the Tap FM, I'm Jimmy Kuska. Here's what you need to know in the Chippewa Valley. Eau Claire Students Transit is facing a shortage of bus drivers for the upcoming school year. The director of safety says they need 13 more drivers, which is more than they've been short on in past years. With fewer drivers, routes will be changed and can possibly cause longer wait times and fuller buses for students. The Wisconsin DOT waived certain parts of its testing for bus drivers last year in an effort to increase the number of school bus drivers statewide. However, bus companies and school districts said it hasn't made much of a difference as the shortages continue. Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan asked for the release of security footage at the U.S. Capitol from last week when fellow Wisconsin Congressman Derek Van Orden yelled at Senate pages. Congressional leaders condemned Van Orden's act last week. The footage is being reviewed by U.S. Capitol Security, according to a release from Representative Brian Stile. Van Orden said he won't publicly apologize. And the National Weather Service says it'll be hot and humid for the next couple of days, but rain chances return this weekend. For Civic Media News, I'm Jimmy Kuska.
She's the newest of seven elected Wisconsin Supreme Court justices. Janet Protasiewicz begins her 10-year term in August when she is sworn in. It's a longtime tradition which includes use of the court's seal created in 1848. But did you know it features the scales of justice, but not carried by a blindfolded Greek goddess. Instead, a hand holds the scales, representing justice is in human hands. It also means everything is official once the seal is stamped on any court documents. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Barr. Flowers, vegetables, and crab apples, some of the first Marathon County Fair attractions, and showed us proof those crops could grow there. Started in 1868 by the Agricultural Society, the Wisconsin Valley Fair in Wausau began as a place to buy and sell those types of goods. Today, it's considered one of the best in the state, featuring displays, demos, and big-name entertainment included with the price of your ticket. The Wisconsin Valley Fair runs August 1st to the 6th in Wausau. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Barr.
Professor Schwaber, what grade would you give the Supreme Court for their interpretation of the law?
That doesn't really work. The grade ordinarily would be how accurately and thoughtfully and carefully have you interpreted, you know, existing precedents. I tell you what, though, if I were teaching a course in, let's say, logic, and I was asked to grade this work in terms of its coherence and its rigor, a high D.
Wow.
A high D.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry and Jane Mattenair. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
93.5 The Tap. 93.5 The Tap.
Site at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Yeah, we're going to get to the Trump stuff. Yeah, I know everybody's doing the Trump stuff. Everybody talking about the former guy and his legal woes. And should we be doing this or shouldn't we? Or, oh, is this a problem? Yeah, it's a problem. And we're going to get to all of that. But I got to tell you, my mind was somewhere else all day today. And I know this is the biggest story of democracy. And I know everybody should. I get it. It's a big deal. Big deal. But I had a listener send me this Carl Sagan quote. And look, I remember, I'll tell you how old, I'm feeling old. For those who don't know, Carl Sagan was, this famed astronomer, all over the place in the 60s, 70s, and into the 80s. He was being interviewed by billionaire TV mogul Ted Turner, because you remember Ted owned CNN. So he was doing an interview on CNN of Carl Sagan, are you a socialist? And I remember this back in 89. And I remember going, I don't like Ted Turner very much. But it's one of these things that, as I said, it's been around for a while and I've seen it pop up. And I guess it's popping up again. And it's probably a good thing. But I 100% agreed with Carl Sagan back in 89, as I do today. And he said, look, I don't, what is a socialist? He said, I believe government has a responsibility to care for people. He says, I'm talking about making people self-reliant, people able to take care of themselves. There are countries which are perfectly able to do that. The United States is an extremely rich country. It's perfectly able to do that. It chooses not to. It chooses to have homeless people. He says, we're the 19th in the world in infant mortality. 18 other countries save the lives of babies better than we do. And he asked the question, how come? And it's choice. We make these decisions. And he pointed out something that was contentious back in 89. Star Wars, not the TV show, not the movie, but the Reagan era, hey, we're going to have missile defense domes and lasers and all kind of stuff. And they spent an enormous amount of money. And he said, look, we've already spent $20 million on it. And they're probably going to spend $1 trillion. And they did. That came out of your Social Security. He said, think of what that money could be used for education, to help, to bring people up to a sense of self-confidence, was his point. And he said, to improve not just the happiness of people in America, but their economic standing. to improve the competitiveness of the U.S. compared to other countries. We are using our money for the wrong stuff. And again, this idea, you know, not just the happiness of people, but for the entire country, for society. And, you know, my mind was just all over this today, you know, thinking about the old Hobbes quote, you know, that you know, life outside of society is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. And how, you know, as we're tearing apart, as we're being ripped apart on purpose to keep us pitted against each other so that we can be robbed blind, and the resources that we have misused again and again and again, you know, I started just, I'm in this spot going, yeah, the Trump thing's important. And I'm going to get to that. But this, to me, is the central issue of where we are. The central issue of being part of a society that cares for the least among us, the most vulnerable. And again, you know, the people who tell us we're a Christian nation, well, show me in your policy. Don't tell me how pious you are. Don't tell me how much you believe. Show me. Show me the policy. And look, when they overturned Roe, the religious right was all just, you know, all wadded up and tingly in the panties and happy. But where were the policies to follow up on this to go, okay, now we're going to force all these people to have children. We're going to force poor people to have a bunch of children that they can't afford. Great. Where's the policy to help? And I haven't seen that. I've seen none of it because these people don't care. And what's frustrating to me is we can have a society that is much, much better. We can do better. We can be better. And what's frustrating to me, and I was just reading this, and it's an older, it's been a couple of months since this study came out. But this Money Zine .com site. They did a survey of people who, you know, how happy are you in your job? How happy are you with your income? What income would you need to be happy? Because you may remember a number of years ago, there was a Nobel Prize winning study done that said, hey, you know, after 75 grand, you know, life doesn't get much better. You know, having all kinds of money doesn't make your life that much better after 75 grand. Because, you know, at 75 grand, I think this was like 2010, you know, you could afford a decent residence. You could afford a decent car. You could take a vacation occasionally. You could have the decent things in life. You could have that Leave It to Beaver kind of existence that you know, one income could support a family and you could live a good life, have, you know, see movies an hour then, do other things other than just exist. And they wanted to know, you know, is that reality? And they went into the workforce and they asked people, what do you do? How much you make? And, you know, what do you need? And that 75 number has jumped up to about 100 grand, people are saying, to be happy. Need 100 grand to be happy. And, you know, they went through and talked about the different industries and how far they are from that number of being happy. For instance, retail workers are the poorest paid workers around. You know, and, you know, to get to that 100 grand level, they'd need like a 400% increase in their salaries. And it's no wonder that they have such a high turnover rate. Something like 60-70% of people in retail end up leaving for another crummy job chasing nickels. And as I'm going through this, my mind is in this place of, you know, back when I was in high school civics class, you know, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, this idea that you can pursue your happiness and government could be there to help with smart policy that puts guardrails to capitalism so that we don't end up where we are in this moment, where you've got gazillionaires who have more money than 10 generations forward are ever going to be able to spend. And yet we've got kids growing up in the same housing project that I grew up in, not having anything to eat tonight. There is something enormously wrong. And I agree with Carl Sagan on this. Something enormously wrong in how we spend our money. And it came back to me as I was thinking about, you know, my own journey and my own life and being fortunate enough, you know, after I got out of college, you know, I got a job working in the freight industry, which, you know, back in the late 80s was making about 18 bucks an hour at the, you know, the top, or 18 and some change. So I did that, went over to the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics. They've got this cool inflation calculator to where you can go back in time and you can go, hey, if I made 18 bucks an hour in 1987, what would that be in today's dollars? And it'd be almost 50 bucks an hour in today's dollars. Yeah, almost 50 bucks an hour. I know that job right now pays just 30. So that $20 an hour difference, and I would argue that that's the difference between making a reasonable living and having a good living, being happy. Where did that $20 go? That $20 an hour, 40 hours a week, 800 bucks, you know, where did that money go? And we know it went to the very wealthy, it went to the shareholders, it went to our investor class. And how did that happen? And you know where I'm going with this, because I say this all the time. We allowed politicians to push really bad policy. We allowed politicians to allow corporate America to beat up on organized labor and collective bargaining. And we went for a tax code that said, no, you are the smart one. You know what to do with the money much better than the collective of society. No, you keep it. You keep it. You know what to do with it. And the thing is they did. The individual at the top knows exactly what to do with the money, and that is make more money for themselves. But how does that help society? How does that help us move into that direction of life, liberty, pursuit of happiness? Well, you could pursue your happiness. Yeah, but it's kind of hard when the entire system is being rigged against your ability to make a reasonable wage. Because they're colluding. I know. Oh, you can't say that. Okay, they're coordinating. We'll use a different C word. And the sad reality is what happens is people's lives get much more difficult. And one of the things from this study that came out is going, look, you know, people don't have the kind of money that they need to be able to do the things that they need. They look, you know, they do this by cutting going on vacation. They cut it by avoiding social outings, by, you know, by going having weddings, and they do it by tightening the belt. And what does that mean, not just for the individual's happiness, but for society? And I know we don't ever in this country want to talk about the good of the society, of the commons, and what we have all in this. No, we can't talk about that, because that's socialism. And I've been accused of being a socialist more than once, of which I don't particularly say I am. But I do think some social policies for the good of everyone is smart policy, and something we as voting people, especially in the working class, should probably want. So this is where my mind was today. And I'm just... I'm in this weird spot, but I want to hear your thoughts on this. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
And I go back to this, you know, when I got out of college back in the late 80s, the reality is that the job that I got, you know, a menial manual labor job, was paying close to 100 grand a year. And they've destroyed that massive redistribution of wealth is what we have seen. Let's go to the phones. We got Kurt from Akron on line one. Kurt, how you doing today?
Well, good evening, Rick. And I just want to tell you, I enjoyed your monologue there that you talked about. And it got me thinking. Remember the old TV show Dennis the Menace before you and I were even thought of?
Yep.
Okay. There was an episode where they were talking about the space program, which at that time would have been the Mercury program. The beginning of the space program under Kennedy. You know how they supported the space program, at least according to this, so take it for what it's worth? You know how they did that?
No, how'd they do it?
Okay. The kids actually took their allowances, what little allowances they had, which would have been a lot of money in those days when you adjust for inflation, and they bought trading stamps, or they bought, you know, like savings bonds to help fund the space program. That's what we lost in 1981 when we got Ronald Reagan. We stopped being a community of the commons where we're all in this together, and we stopped investing in big dreaming, you know, we stopped investing in things that we were dreaming of, you know, like going to the moon and, you know, helping to create technology that, you know, in the 1960s seemed like a dream that we're living in reality. Science fiction became science fact because of all that investment of the commons working together. You know, you were talking about you made $18 an hour. My dad started working at the Timken Company back in 1973 after he got out of the Marine Corps. He started out making $250 a week, all right? In 1973, right. He thought he owned the world. We had a house. He bought a brand new 1976 Trans Am, fully loaded, for $5,000 out the door. You know, we took vacations. We had the television. You know, we had all the gadgets and stuff because they were affordable. And, you know, I can remember my sister was at Kent State, and I was getting ready to go to Kent State. And my brother was so worried about my mom and dad's finances. My brother couldn't have been more than maybe 11, 12 years old at the time. And we're talking 1995. And at that time, my dad actually had to sit him down and explain to him economics and said something to the effect of, you know what a family of five today is considered to be fiscally affluent? You remember what it was in 1995?
I don't.
$75,000 for a family of five to be considered fiscally affluent at that time.
Yeah. You know what's interesting, though, if I can cut you off? Because I just went to the magic calculator over at the BLS. That $200 a week that he was making back in
250.
Oh, 250. That's even more. That $250 a week that he was making back then was close to $1,800 today a week. Stop and think about that. That's almost $100,000 a year.
Well, and by the time he retired in 2009, he was making over $100,000 a year.
Yeah.
Working in a union job.
Yep.
And, you know, it's just, we need to start investing in people. But my question to you is, and I'm sorry I went long with that little history lesson, is how do you convince 2.5 generations that have grown up under trickle-down economics that they don't know anything different over the past 40 years? And some people actually made their fortune under trickle-down economics. How do you convince our generation, the Gen Xers and the millennials and the early Gen Zers, how do you convince them that trickle-down is not the way to go and Bidenomics is the way to go?
I think you tell the story you just told about your father. I think the more we realize how the economy used to be and how it used to work for working people, because we had a strong labor movement that demanded a fair share of the wealth that was created, I think the more we tell these stories, because, look, people are struggling. I mean, the numbers are out there. People are working longer and harder. It no longer takes one income or two incomes for a family to survive. Now we're pushing kids into the workplace. You know, the argument, are we at the final stage of capitalism? You know, you start looking at this and people are at some point have to raise their head and go, there's got to be a better way.
Absolutely.
But I appreciate the thoughts and great story, Kurt. Thanks so much. But no, I mean, the numbers that Kurt just laid out there, I mean, right to my point, his father in 1973 made $250 a week, which, you know, again, the economic wizardry over at the BLS calculator, and you could take a look at it yourself, comes up to 1790 $1,790 a week. Could you live a decent life today on $1,790 a week? Could you? I think you can. It's more than I make. But this is what a strong labor movement did. And it came with health care. It came with retirement security. It came with days off, paid days off, vacations. Yeah, I mean, different, total different environment than where we are today, which is, you know, you could be a gig worker. You're on your own. You're on your own. But that is the question, isn't it, Kurt? How do we get them? Let's go to the phones. Got Alice on, too. Alice, how are you?
I'm doing all right. How about yourself?
I'm getting there. What's on your mind?
What I wanted to say is this. We keep hearing from the Republicans and the right wing, anything that seems to be for the benefit of the people, they start screaming, socialism, communism. They don't even know what the meaning of the words are. You know, communism,
they know it's an ism.
Basically means, but you know, this is for you people out there listening. Communism means the government owns everything. Socialism means that the people supposedly own everything and the government basically gets a share. And another thing, they scream all the time, well, look what it's doing to Europe. Not really. They still have millionaires and billionaires there, not as many as we do here in the States or in Saudi Arabia. But one of the, I think it's Norway. The minimum wage there is $25 an hour. And I was discussing this with one of my right-wing people, and they were saying, yeah, but McDonald's is probably, I'm like, no, actually a hamburger is pretty much, the food is the same price as it's here in America. It's just the money is divided more equally. So, you know, the problem is people are screaming. They don't know what words mean. We see that with the right wing all the time. They use words. They don't know what they mean. They make up their own meaning. And again, that goes back to ignorance. So
they love the poorly educated.
Have a good evening, Rick.
Thanks, Alice. Appreciate it. Love the poorly educated. You know, make up our own words. No, but this, you know, I don't want to beat up on people because, you know, the reality is we've been force-fed this outrage candy for so long. And the reason I didn't start with Trump today is because, look, you know, this is the important stuff. Yeah, democracy, wildly important. And yes, I'm not going to argue that that is the important issue of our moment. But everybody else is talking about that, too. Nobody talks about the economic well-being of the working class. Nobody talks about, you know, protecting people on the job. And I say it all the time. Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. I don't care what they say. I don't care about the flowery language or the best words. Just look at what they do. I know what Joe Biden's doing. He's investing in infrastructure. We're reshoring manufacturing. He's doing the work. Jelly Bucket Joe is showing up, doing the work. But what's the grand old party doing? What work are they doing? Well, I saw their budget, and I think I talked about this earlier last month. They want to gut everything our government does. I was looking at some numbers of, they want to cut OSHA because, you know, we just had, the president came out and said we should have, you know, tell people about, you know, there's protections for working in heat. Yeah, good luck on that. You know, OSHA is supposed to enforce a lot of this stuff. Now, what's interesting is, you know, right now, it, according to the AFL-CIO, it would take OSHA 190 years to inspect every workplace in this country with their current staff. Only 190 years. So I hope you feel safer. But what the Republicans want to do is they want to gut their funding even further, cut it by 15%, which would then make it even worse. And the estimate is probably about 300 years before they could inspect every workplace in the country. And isn't that wonderful? Now, again, which side are you on in this? Are you on the side of the worker who needs protection or the owner who, you know, these job-killing regulations are making me tired? Which side? Republicans are always going to be on the side of big business because they don't want these onerous rules that protect you at work. The Mine Safety and Health Administration, they're facing a 29% cut thanks to the Republicans. And you know, there's a war on coal, didn't you know? Never mind the war on the coal miners. No, that's not a real thing. And again, you're talking about cutting the one agency that's supposed to keep them safe. The National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, they're the ones who do all the workplace safety and health research. They're the research folks. They're slashing their budget by 32%. The Office of Solicitor in the Department of Labor, they want to cut their budget by 25%. You get this sense of what's going on here? The National Labor Relations Board, they want to gut by a third. You get the sense of how they want to gut the one organization in our government that protects working people? You getting a sense? Because again, I go back to Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. And here's the thing. That budget doesn't stand a snowball's chance in passing. That's their messaging priority. Think about that. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day striking Teamsters in Minneapolis defied martial law. They stopped scab trucks, forcing the release of their strike leaders. Armed with bayonets and machine guns, the National Guard had patrolled the streets for nearly a week. They seized scores of strikers and union leaders and threw them into military stockades. Drivers were outraged. They defied Governor Olson and Major General Walsh, who, on behalf of the Citizens Alliance and trucking bosses, were determined to break the strike. Soon after strikers were imprisoned, drivers began chasing scab trucks across the city. Multiple reports poured in of picketers forcing trucks to stop. Some unloaded their cargo onto bridges. Others chased, captured, and damaged the scab trucks. Strikers ripped ignition wires out, forced scabs from the wheel, and then disappeared before police and the National Guard could arrive to retaliate. In just 3 hours, strikers had overturned nearly 70 trucks. Unable to stop the superior force of striking drivers, Bill Brown, Vincent, and Miles Dunn were ordered unconditionally released from the military stockades. Now, employers, the governor, and other strike-breaking agencies were eager to propose peace to federal mediators. But they proposed to scrap the terms of their earlier May agreement. In response, the leaders of Local 574 issued a general strike call. In it, they asked, quote, "Is there one man so blind as not to see that if 574 is allowed to go down to defeat under the brutal hammering of military despotism, the whole labor movement of the city will have been dealt a mortal blow? Union men, brothers, sisters, fellow workers, what are you going to do about it? We appeal to you for solidarity." Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Senator Tom Cotton, a far-out right-winger, is to good public policy what a boll weevil is to a good cotton crop. Totally destructive. But he is politically candid. Rather than disguising his racial bigotry, for example, Tom flaunts it, as he did last month in an open letter to the retail giant Target. While the senator is usually a devoted corporate-hugging Republican, he lashed out at Target for business policies that he furiously condemns as racially discriminatory against white people. What popped Tom's cork was the chain's pledge to increase the number of black people it hires by 20%. "Holy Dixieland," wailed Cotton. "Hiring more of them means fewer jobs for us white people." He insisted that Caucasians had the right to take any and all of Target's jobs. Interestingly, Target's gesture to racial equality was made 3 years ago, with no peep of protest from the now infuriated Cotton. What changed? The GOP's dog-whistling tune, the new politically correct line of anti-black racists, even parroted by today's Republican Supreme Court, is that all efforts to provide racial fairness and balance are, get this, illegal racism against the white majority. So Cotton is just scurrying aboard his party's latest anti-black bandwagon, proclaiming that whites must be protected from racial progress. Not only are Tom and his ilk threatening teachers, librarians, and local governments for promoting equality, but also brand-name corporations that they claim to be woke. That is, not solely focused on profits, but also promoting a little attention to America's need for social justice. This is Jim Hightower saying, ironically, Tom's clique piously claims to be devout Christians. But guess who was supremely woke? Jesus. Tom Cotton needs to review the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus declared that those who hunger and thirst for justice are blessed.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I got to tell you, the one thing I give Donald Trump credit for is he leans in. He announces his own indictments. In fact, today he leaned in so far. He said, look, he's facing 561 years in prison. Send me money. I give him credit, man. He's a grifter to the end, fleecing the flock. But, you know, I got to wonder, at some point, do the people start going, I don't know, that doesn't sound like a good investment to me. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the big indictments. And is it really 561 years in prison? I'm sure he has done the math. I'm sure he's up at 3 in the morning on the golden can, you know, imagining what's going to happen to him. But tomorrow in Washington, D.C. and all across the country, there are events going on, the Not Above the Law events. There's a rapid response going on the 3rd. And in D.C. on Madison Drive Northwest and 3rd Street Southwest near the gallery. This is getting people involved and, well, making sure we hold someone accountable. And that's why I've asked Christine Wood to come talk with us. Christine is the campaign co-director with the Declaration for American Democracy Coalition. Christine, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's a historic day, a historic week. Excited to be here and talk about what folks are doing across the country and in Washington, D.C. to make sure that they're, you know, outlining and living up to the moment right now and calling for justice.
And the message is nobody is above the law. I mean, this is the Absolutely. Thing that I think has to be hammered again and again and again. Nobody's above the law, from president to janitor. I don't care. You break the law, you're held accountable.
Of course. And, you know, of course, this is the 3rd indictment, as everyone watching knows. But this is one that many folks have been waiting for since January 6th, 2.5 years ago. You know, we all tuned in to the January 6th hearings, which really laid out that Trump knew he lost the election, but still led a criminal conspiracy theory to overturn our election. So this is a serious indictment. And I think a lot of Americans have been waiting for this moment for a long time.
Now, I've had a lot of people tell me, well, aren't we going, isn't this a slippery slope? Aren't we opening up, you know, a door that we don't really want to, because, you know, down the road, you know, we're going to start indicting presidents for any reason. For instance, and I'm sure you've seen this, Republicans are talking about impeaching Joe Biden. Not sure why. I don't even think they know why, but they need an impeachment. And Jesse Waters said, hey, the Fox News mouthpiece, you should do it during the Trump trial, because, hey, that would make that, see, they're both equal kind of nonsense. There's nothing equal here. This is a guy who really tried to undermine our democracy and ended 250 years of a peaceful transfer of power.
Absolutely. And I think the American people can see right through that. You know, none of the, you know, claims that the, you know, extremist Republicans are pushing around Hunter Biden even measure up to classified documents, let alone overturning, you know, an attempt to overturn the election results. And the January 6th hearings, but also the, you know, indictment papers themselves clearly lay out that there was a multi-pronged plan to, you know, pressure election officials to either not certify the election results, change votes, et cetera. It showed that there was a pressure campaign on even, you know, through the Justice Department, the fake elector scandal, and then also a pressure campaign on Mike Pence. There was a series of actions that Donald Trump led with his allies to overturn a U.S. election and disenfranchise the American public. So none of the claims that are being pushed right now regarding Joe Biden have any real weight to them, let alone measuring up to an attempt to overturn U.S. democracy itself.
And that's the point here. I mean, you know, every time someone brings up but Hillary, but Joe, but Obama, but whoever, I always say, I don't care about but, I care about this. This is what we're talking about. We're talking about a former president who is accused of all of these crimes, of which I don't know there are very good defenses, but he's going to get his day in court like anyone else, and he should be held accountable like anyone else.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's why, you know, as you mentioned earlier, people across the country are taking action. As soon as the news of the indictment broke, we had, you know, 70 rallies scheduled across the country to hold Donald Trump accountable and to let people across this country know where the American people stand on this issue, which is nobody is above the law, not even a president of the United States. And, you know, the democracy belongs to all of us, and we need to show up to defend it. So that's why, you know, we're supporting these actions that are being hosted by local folks in 70 communities from San Diego to Denver, Chicago to D.C., New York. And then you mentioned in Washington, D.C. So, you know, the American people are standing up and they're making their voices clear that this is not acceptable, and we need to hold people accountable, even the president.
Yeah, it's interesting. As you're talking, I just checked my email, and Brad sent me an email giving me, but Hillary. here's the weird thing, and I got to address this quick because thank you, Brad. I appreciate it. And you want to email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do want to hear your thoughts. But Hillary, there were 4 years when the former guy was in the office. Had a Republican appointed DOJ guy, had all of that, all the powers, and they didn't make a case. They weren't willing. They were unable to, however you want to frame that. They didn't get to lock her up because, well, there wasn't anything really there to lock her up over.
Absolutely. There's no kind of basis for any of their claims previously. And right now there are mounds of evidence, and the amount that went into this investigation and the January 6th hearings is so much more vast in scope than anything previously we've ever seen. So, yeah. You know, the facts speak for themselves. And, you know, the case in the indictment is very compelling. I'm sure that you've heard kind of the case that they're making, that Donald Trump essentially in the lead up to January 6th, not just on January 6th itself, really organized a conspiracy to overturn the election. And yeah. I think nothing regarding, you know, Hillary or other accusations compares to that. And, you know, you mentioned earlier that you don't know what maybe the Republicans are even indicting Biden for, looking to impeach Biden for, is it's really an impeachment in pursuit of an individual. As you know, Donald Trump got impeached, and now they want to impeach someone as well. And it's just a tactic to deflect against the reality here that, unfortunately, you know, the favorite of the Republican, you know, presidential nominee has multiple, you know, it has been multiple indictments on him. So it's a deflection tactic, and we need to call that out, and we need to stick to what's important here, which is justice for, you know, the many counts that Trump is facing.
No, and that's the thing that's so important to point out. There are many counts here. And here's the thing. I truly believe that if it's not Donald Trump, a lot of these things go away. That mm-hmm. former presidents of the past wouldn't have done the really outrageously stupid things that Trump did. His arrogance, I think, is what really got him into the most trouble, because we have allowed a lot of leniency for people in the past. I mean, I go back to the Reagan era. You know, there were tons of things we could have gone after him over and didn't. George W. Bush, same thing. Lots of things. Had he just given the documents back, had he not, you know, had the overt act, I'm going to be with you, let's go. None of this stuff would have gotten to this point, I don't think. Do you agree?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that, you know, what we're seeing here is truly unprecedented. I know we use that word a lot in this era, but we've truly never seen anything like it. Nothing measures up to trying to steal and overturn an election and disenfranchise democracy, you know, itself. Typically, as you mentioned, we have seen presidents follow democratic norms, including a peaceful transfer of power. I mean, that is the American democracy at its core, and its founding was based on this peaceful transfer of power. And we've never seen anything like this. And it's important. It's that, you know, it's important to show for the future that this won't be tolerated in the United States, that you can't do that. It's important for us to set that new precedent, and then also pass legislation to to protect the franchise. We need to continue to do that in an ongoing way.
Absolutely. No, we are most certainly living history. Our great, great, great grandchildren are going to learn about this, down the road. I mean, that's the one thing that I can be certain on. And the question is, which side of history will we be on? You're listening to The Rick Smith Show with Christine Wood. She's a campaign co-director with the Declaration for American Democracy Coalition. You can check out their website, ourfreedomsourvote.com. We'll get links out on social media. How you can take a look at that. Now, you talked about the election, obviously the attempt to steal the election, and the claims that there's all this fraud out there. Everywhere you look, there's fraud. There are millions. I look at Georgia, is telling the Secretary of State, just find me, 14,000 votes? Claiming he won by 400,000, but just find me the 14,000 I need to win. That doesn't sound like a perfect phone call. It sounds like, old school mob kind of, hey, that's a mighty nice house you got there. Shame if something would happen to it kind of talk. This is where, talking about our ballots and our elections, I think is really important. And this has to be, in my view, extremely transparent.
Yeah, absolutely. And, right now, of course, we're talking about the behavior related to the indictment, pressuring of Brad Raffensperger and other election officials around the election results. And of course, what happened that day on January 6th. But just for a moment, I just want to point out that there have been grave implications ever since then as well, is we have seen now a massive mistrust of election workers in communities across this country. And that's been shown in polls, in reports from think tanks that specialize in this. Election workers themselves are quitting en masse. There was a recent, Brennan said a report that said, I think it was one in five election workers were planning to leave their jobs over a period of time. And that's because they're receiving these threats, because the environment that Trump created through the big lie has, and through vilifying election workers, has really had grave implications on our elections. And that has a ripple effect. If we have a lack of election workers and trust in our elections, it leads to, people being more susceptible to misinformation. It also leads to just less functional elections, longer lines at the polls. So, we're talking, of course, about the massive issue here of Donald Trump working to overturn the U.S. election, but the damage did not stop on January 6th. We have seen grave implications across the country, from the increased mistrust in our elections to also a wave of anti-voter bills introduced across the country. So we're still seeing the impacts of this. So holding Donald Trump accountable is what we have to do immediately, but we also have to repair this damage that he and his allies have left us, our democracy, in a weaker state. But it's good to see that so many people are mobilizing and I think these events are a testament to that, that folks are willing to demonstrate their support and to fight for our democracy, which is critical.
No, this is most certainly a participatory moment, and I'm hoping folks will get out to the events. If folks wanted to find an event in their neighborhood, I know you said there are like 70 of them across the country, where would they go for more information?
Oh, thanks. So you can find a website in your neighborhood at ourfreedomourvote.com. So that's ourfreedomsourvote.com. Freedoms, plural.
We'll get linked.
So check out that website and you'll find an event near you. This is definitely a participatory moment. Like you said, it's really important that we continue to show up, call for accountability, and talk about the democracy that that we strive to be, one that's truly for and by the people, and push back on these attempts to disenfranchise us.
And this is why I think this whole process has to be televised. Prime time, we should be holding these hearings and these court proceedings so that people can see what actually happened. Not all of the kangaroo court kind of stuff that Rudy Giuliani and his clan held here in Gettysburg or at the Four Seasons Landscaping Company. But what actually gets said under oath. And, for me, there's a huge difference between Rudy on the pavement at the landscaping company and what they said in court. So for me, that's what we need to see. That's what needs to be reported on.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that even, you know, as the January 6th hearings went underway, that did such a service educating the nation on the facts of this case, to the extent that almost anyone on the street can kind of walk you through Trump's plan to overturn the election. But we need to continue talking about this and tuning in as this plays out, because this is truly a historic moment that's going to lay the groundwork for the future. For it's going to, you know, this accountability is essential to protecting us and our democracy from anyone ever doing anything like this again. So folks need to tune in and continue to be present in this moment and be vocal on the need for accountability.
OurFreedomsOurVote.com is the website. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Christine Wood, I appreciate you taking time for us. I hope you'll come back and give us some information of how this is going and what's going on down the road. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Want to hear your thoughts. Will you be tuning in? Will you be paying attention to the big doings, especially as he's possibly mugshotted down in Georgia? Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. I want to hear your thoughts. Back after this. Stick around.
Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1939. That was the day that the Hatch Act was enacted. The law was named after Senator Carl Hatch, a Democratic senator from New Mexico. The Hatch Act limits political activities by federal employees. One of the reasons the law was passed was due to allegations of corruption by the Works Progress Administration. The WPA was a key program of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal plan to put people back to work during the Great Depression. But critics of the WPA alleged that the program was being used as a form of political patronage, and that the jobs were exchanged as a way to secure votes for the Democratic Party. Although an investigation found no conclusive proof of the allegations, Congress decided to act to define what was appropriate political engagement for a federal employee. Except for the president and the vice president, all federal employees and employees of the District of Columbia must follow the Hatch Act guidelines. Under the act, federal employees cannot use the authority of their job to interfere with an election. They cannot be a candidate to a public office in a partisan election. They cannot participate in political activity while at work or while wearing a government uniform or driving a government vehicle. But the Hatch Act does not completely stop federal employees from participating in our political system. If they are off the clock, federal employees can still attend political rallies, contribute money to candidates, campaign for candidates, and help register voters. Ensuring the individual rights of free speech and elections free of corruption can be a difficult balancing act, especially for the thousands who call Uncle Sam their boss. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So John sent me an email during the break. Evidently, Tarrump is now the new name for Trump. John says Tarrump is going to be the first president to run for president from prison. And he's going to win in a landslide. I'm not sure who Tarrump is. Or Tarrump. He meant Trump. No, and here's the thing. Here's the thing, John. Who knows? He may run and he may win. I'm not saying he's not going to. But he wouldn't be the first person to run for president from prison. That was Eugene V. Debs, you know, years ago, you know, back during World War I, I believe it was. He was arrested for giving an anti-war speech, and he was locked up for it. I think he did like 10 years. I think he was sentenced to like 10 years. And he got over 1 million votes from prison. So wouldn't be the first, but he would be the first if he won. He'd be the first one who would win. And look, I'm not saying that that's impossible. And this is the weird part, because we've got a media structure in this country that is so screwed up that they're actually, you know, they're playing this up. You know, I saw CNN, and I don't know what's going on at CNN. They're losing their minds. But, you